the water went from the roof, it went into the walls, it destroyed the roof, destroyed the walls, and then it got into the floor and destroyed the floors.
Unsafe working conditions at the Bethel Fire Station. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 30th of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a debate over whether homeowners should be able to have their own windmills in Homer.
I am no art critic, but in my opinion, it is nothing but ugly.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Operations are ramping up at the Rail Belt Complex of Fires. The management team is leveling up, and 8 additional crews are being assigned to the fires, bringing staffing to around 350 people. The biggest fire in the complex, the Minto Flats South Blaze, has consumed in excess of 340,000 acres. Or about 600 square miles. Fire crews have been working for weeks to protect cabins, native allotments, a natural gas exploration rig, and other scattered resources. The fire is burning west of Nenana and the Tanana River and north of the Kantishna River. Hot, dry, windy weather this week has resulted in large acreage gains in the fire. The state's second largest wildfire is the Little Black One, northeast of Circle. The fire has burned 257,000 acres between the Yukon and Little Black Rivers. The focus is on protecting remote allotments and cabins. Statewide, the Alaska Fire Service reports 73 active fires, 9 of which are staffed. Fairbanks is socked in with wildfire smoke, and air quality is in the unhealthy range. Borough air quality specialist Jim Connor says conditions have been deteriorating since the winds shifted early this morning.
We expect this to continue as long as the winds continue from the west, and that may happen until after midnight tonight, according to the forecast, the weather forecast.
The Alaska Fire Service reports that the smoke drifting into Fairbanks is coming from the Wood River and Rail Belt Complex fires southwest of Fairbanks. Connor says air quality is the worst it's been in Fairbanks this summer. The borough is recommending anyone needing a break from the smoke spend time in buildings with high-quality air filtration systems like the borough library. He says if the smoke persists, the borough may set up smoke respite centers at other locations. The world's largest firefighting aircraft is in Fairbanks. The new one-of-a-kind Evergreen Aviation supertanker is a converted 747 that holds 20,000 gallons of water and retardant. Supertanker program manager Jim Baines says the capacity is 8 times that of conventional tankers and uses a pressurized system to disperse its payload.
You know, we've got a big head of pressure behind it. It's coming out of those nozzles. There's 4 16-inch nozzles that come out of the belly. And it's the product's being dispersed at about 50,000 pounds of thrust. So it, you know, it shoots straight down, a couple hundred feet before it starts to break up and disperse.
Baines says the plane can make drops from higher altitudes, allowing safer and even nighttime operations. The supertanker's nozzles can be turned on and off, enabling it to hit several fires in the course of a single flight. But if it drops its entire load, it can wet a 3-mile-long football field's wide swath. The supertanker was volunteered by Evergreen to make a drop on the massive Rail Belt Complex fires west of Nenana today. But Maggie Rogers with the State Division of Forestry says conditions were too smoky for the flight. The new aircraft was employed to fight wildfires in Spain earlier this summer, but the Alaska work will be the first time it's been used in the U.S. Bain says the supertanker is not designed to replace older firefighting aircraft, but add a specialized new tool to the fleet.
You know, we could base it in a central location such as Fairbanks, where we're at right now, and have just a huge operating radius because we're going at, you know, we're flying at 600 miles an hour. We can cover a huge area.
Bain says the supertanker was outfitted at Evergreen's service facility in Arizona and underwent a stringent certification process as part of a 5-year, $50 million project. He says Evergreen has a contract with the state of California for use of the aircraft and hopes to secure similar contracts with other states and the federal government. The Bethel Fire Station is in imminent danger of collapse. That's the conclusion of an independent engineer who recently examined the building. Now the fire department is running a skeleton crew inside the building while the city looks for money to replace it. KYUK's Shane Iverson took a tour of the fire station and has this story.
The Bethel Fire Department responds to over 700 requests for help each year, but now they're the ones in need. Fire Captain Bill Howell.
The water went from the roof, it went into the walls, it destroyed the roof, destroyed the walls, and then it got into the floor and destroyed the floors.
To get a look at the framing, engineers peeled off sheetrock and siding. Howell shows a section where the drywall has been ripped away. Visible is the wooden frame, literally crumbling as Howell runs his hand across it.
Wood falling, right out of the stud walls. It just, falling right out. It's like buildings held together with toothpicks and foam at this point.
In response to the danger, the fire department is no longer allowing their volunteers into the building. Only two staff members are allowed in at one time, and on-call staff no longer spends the night at the station. Instead, they monitor calls from a radio at home. Last winter, the city used state funds to put extra supports under the floor to keep it from collapsing. But the new inspection by Little Susitna Engineering details all of the building's problems, and they are worse than expected. The report says the building is unsafe for occupancy and is a significant danger to life and property. Howell walks across the vehicle storage area. It's about 40 feet high. Near the north wall, a giant beam is supported by posts stretching high towards the ceiling. They were added as a way to shore up that ceiling. Similar supports are all over the station now, but this north wall was a priority, says Howell.
Now, this wall is especially scary. During the removal of the sheetrock, the roof actually subsided about an inch while the workers were removing this. And then they started hearing popping and cracking throughout the whole roof structure. And yeah, so it was a little bit spooky for everybody. And they put in this emergency shoring right here just to complete the job of removing the sheetrock from the walls.
From the outside, you can see the inner workings of the north wall where the siding has been removed. Howell picks away at the rotten frame that's supposed to be supporting the walls and ceiling.
You can see the wall studs here have rotted out as well, right against the foam here. The foam is compressed here and buckled, and you can see that it's kind of like got weight on it. And if you look at the plywood here, you can see it's bowed out on the side of the building. And this actually shows that this side of the building, it's actually dropped a little bit.
City Manager Lee Foley says the damage can be traced back to the little rubber washers that are supposed to keep water from entering screw holes on the roof.
Rubber washers, if they're exposed to the sun or the elements, start to deteriorate. On top of that, for some reason, ravens like to eat the rubber washers. And when the washers are removed from around where the bolts are, the water comes in. Once it starts coming in, it starts soaking up all that stuff and ruining the wood and everything else.
The city of Bethel does not have money to build a new station. Over the last few years, the city council has cut almost 15 positions, mainly as a consequence of high energy prices. On Tuesday, the city council unanimously approved a resolution to request funding for a replacement fire station. The hope is that the state or federal sources like FEMA will put up the necessary funding. Foley has already written letters to the Alaska delegation as well as local representatives. He says Governor Sean Parnell got a firsthand look at the building when he visited as lieutenant governor in January of 2008.
He crawled around on his hands and knees underneath the building looking at it. And so he had a first-hand idea of what was happening.
A new fire station would cost an estimated $5 to $7 million to construct. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, developing markets for fish products that would normally be considered waste.
We're starting to see a lot of fish oils being put into diets for farm animals and certainly a lot into pets as well.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Senator Lisa Murkowski has teamed up with Louisiana Democrat Mary Landrieu to introduce a bill that would give coastal states revenue from offshore oil and gas development. States like Alaska would get a 37.5% stake in developing energy projects offshore. That includes royalties, bonuses, and rent payments. Murkowski says in Alaska, about half of that money would go to state government. Alaska Native regional and village corporations would get a third, and then the final 20% would go to coastal communities. Murkowski says the funds could help oil and gas producing states with infrastructure and the costs that come with development.
Those of us that are producing states that do have opportunities offshore recognize that even though the resource might be offshore, there is activity, there is impact to those coastal states.
Murkowski notes that states that host oil and gas production onshore within their borders on federal land get 50% revenue sharing. Murkowski and Senator Landrieu say the program would encourage coastal states to allow oil and gas drilling off their shores. Opponents of the revenue sharing plan say that money should go to the federal government and the nation as a whole. The panel that shapes federal fish policy for Alaskan waters is launching a new committee to connect with rural residents of the state. But some regional leaders say the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council's new Rural Community Outreach Committee still falls short of the goal of full council membership. From KNOM in Nome, Jesse Zink reports.
In May, Unalakleet fisherman Art Ivanoff asked Senator Lisa Murkowski to consider legislation that would create four tribal seats on the 11-member North Pacific Council. Ivanoff and many other rural residents of the state have expressed concern in recent years that the North Pacific Council is overly dominated by industry representatives. In a response this month, Murkowski urged Ivanoff to look to the new Rural Community Outreach Committee. Ivanoff says that's not sufficient.
What I'm hoping is that alongside with this native outreach, we can move forward simultaneously to see if we could gain some seats, voting seats for tribal members. Without a voting seat, we're just going to be given advice. And I guess that's the bottom line, is we're going to be serving as an advisor capacity. We've served that many times over. And what we need are those actual seats.
Myron Nanning is president of the Association of Village Council Presidents based in Bethel. His region has seen declining salmon runs that Nanning blames on excessive bycatch by the Bering Sea pollock fishery. He agrees an advisory committee isn't enough.
All the committees do is just make recommendations and suggestions. The council ultimately votes for implementation of regulation. Just an outreach committee is not going to do anything on actions taken by the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. But if we do have seats on the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, then it will impact whatever the council is dealing with at that time. But right now, our villages who are impacted by the bycatches are completely excluded by the system.
The seven-member outreach committee will be chaired by Eric Olson. Olson also chairs the full North Pacific Council. He says it's a mistake to think the committee is for Native advocacy. He sees its purpose as one of Native outreach.
The premise that this committee was set up to be an avenue for tribal input, I think, is not necessarily the case. My take on this is not going to be like field hearings where we take testimony from folks and then advocate for them. It's more important to get that input directly to the council. This committee to help folks in rural Alaska understand how the council works and ways that they can improve their participation at the council meetings themselves.
The outreach committee is set to hold its meetings in Anchorage. Nanning says that's not a good start.
If they're meeting in Anchorage, there's nothing rural about it. It's set up to be excluding the people that are going to be impacted by any information that this committee might be gathering.
But Olson says logistical and financial considerations force the meeting to be held in Alaska's largest city.
Anchorage is a central location for folks to come in. It's tough for us to hit every region of the state right now. If we had unlimited funds, it would definitely be a lot easier to do that, but that's not the case.
Olson himself is an Alaska native from Dillingham who works for the Community Development Quota Group in the Yukon Delta. CDQ groups take a share of the Bering Sea fisheries and reinvest them in coastal communities. Ivanoff says it's good to have native voices on the North Pacific Council, but there also needs to be non-industry representation.
We're looking for members of federally recognized tribes to serve on the council. We want voting seats of people who have only really one agenda, and that's the health and welfare of the resource. What we're hoping for are seats with people that are not directly employed with the CDQ program or the pollock industry.
Numerous state and federal bodies have created advisory or outreach committees to encourage rural involvement in policymaking. Residents of Bush, Alaska can join subsistence advisory boards, local school boards, and numerous others. Nanning says he appreciates the effort at outreach, but there's a more basic problem with the structure of such advisory groups. The way the groups function isn't congruent with Alaska Native ways of making decisions and may end up excluding participants.
the Roberts Rules of Orders that are utilized by the meeting systems pretty much excludes a lot of input that can be provided on issues that affect people like in the community. Whoever's chairing the meeting puts a time limit on the issues to be discussed. I attended meetings in the past where one elder will say that he's going to make a short comment, but the comment gets to be an extensive one. But trying to convey a point, and ultimately it takes different examples to make that point come across.
The first meeting of the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council's Rural Community Outreach Committee is August the 12th in Anchorage. It's expected to hold one or two meetings annually. Reporting from Nome, I'm Jesse Zink.
The Homer City Council is considering an ordinance that would change city code to make it easier for private property owners to install small wind energy systems on their homes and businesses. But it's clear from this week's council meeting where the ordinance was introduced that it's sure to garner a lot of debate. KBBI's Casey Kelly has more.
Mayor Jim Hornaday, who won't be at the next two council meetings, wanted to make sure that his opinions on the small wind energy ordinance were stated for the record.
I am no art critic, but in my opinion, it is nothing but ugly. It's this ugly tower with an ugly propeller spinning around. I listen to it, and you can hear it. I wouldn't want that anywhere near where I live. It's noise pollution, it's visual pollution, and it really concerns me. My understanding is that the neighbors could not stop this, that these people could just come in and fill out the proper forms, and there it is.
Other council members had similar concerns about the ordinance, which would allow wind turbines of up to 170 feet tall with a rated capacity of 25 kilowatts. The council unanimously approved an extra public hearing to allow more people to weigh in on the topic, but a few people made public comments at this week's meeting, including Terry Yeager, who said he's not opposed to wind power, but wondered if there was a better way than allowing small systems on private property.
Is there a concept where the city could put these in one specific area, working in conjunction with Homer Electric, rather than have these things scattered all over town?
There is one city resident who has asked for permission to put a wind turbine on his property. Richard Kreider lives on the Sterling Highway near Baycrest. He wants to put up a 35-foot tower with 6-foot blades.
It's a 2.5-kilowatt system. It could be anywhere between 20, 30 to maybe 75% on my electric bill that I could save, depending on the wind. I'm right off the bluff on the south side, so I get a constant wind.
Kreider says he's talked with neighbors on both sides of his property, including City Councilman Brian Zack, who recused himself from discussion of the issue at the council meeting due to a potential conflict of interest. Kreider says his neighbors, at least, aren't concerned about potential noise or view problems.
We have a tower, just a temporary pole tower with, you know, tower showing the speed of the wind, and it's just showing it's a smaller height, 25 feet, so it just shows them where approximately would it be and stuff, and they thought it was great.
The wind energy system that Kreider says he's thinking of installing costs about $23,000, but he says he can get up to 55% of that paid for through grants from various government agencies. As energy prices continue to increase, he thinks it's an option that more people will be looking into.
For environmental, and I think to save energy, and I think, you know, this would be good all the way around. I'm from Las Vegas in California, Southern California, so it's kind of rude awakening coming here, and you know, the electrical, and that's not counting. Don't get me on the heating oil. So that's another story.
One part of the ordinance that Kreider would like to see changed is a one-acre restriction on lot size. He says his property is just under an acre in size, and the city should take into account each individual situation rather than having a blanket size restriction. The city council will take more public comment August 10th. A final public hearing and vote will be held on August 24th. In Homer, I'm Casey Kelly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The city of Seward is still dealing with flooded areas after many days of rain. A flood advisory remains in effect for the entire western Prince William Sound area. Seward City Clerk Gene Lewis says that Lowell Point Road opened back up at noon today. The bridge has one lane of traffic going across it.
And then the airport runway is still closed. I hear there's some reported minor damage out there to the runway and an access road out there.
More rain started falling this afternoon, and an overnight total of about 1.5 inches is expected. Lewis says residents need to be mindful about where they are.
We're just, the only thing we're saying is we're cautioning our residents to be vigilant if they're in those areas that are prone to flooding, because the water can rise pretty quickly.
Lewis says that despite the high water, those with plans to visit Seward in the coming days should not have to change their plans.
You know, the boats are going out, people are out there fishing, everything's kind of business as usual, so... You know, as long as Seward Highway is open to get down here, we look pretty good. So, I mean, I think we look real good.
The National Weather Service predicts river levels will crest sometime Friday afternoon. They anticipate this is the last batch of rain for the next several days. In the western Kenai Peninsula, a flood advisory remains in effect into Friday evening. The Kenai River downstream from Skelak Lake is expected to rise slightly again this weekend. Millions of salmon are harvested every summer in Alaska waters, but only part of each fish is turned into tasty fillets. From member station KMXT in Kodiak, Jay Barrett has more.
Salmon fillets are always a hot commodity at fish markets during the summer, and salmon roe, of course, is a delicacy in Japan. But what happens to the rest of the fish? Peter Bechtel is a scientist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Fairbanks. He says the parts of a salmon that do not wind up on the grill hold a lot of possibilities.
First of all, you can make a lot of fish meals. You can make these meals for animals, for pets. Some of these proteins can be used for humans. But we have the oils now. That's probably the hottest story that has come along in the last couple of years. Fish oils then for human consumption. And also we're starting to see a lot of fish oils being put into diets for farm animals and certainly a lot into pets as well. We also have bone meals and things like this. Bone meals can be used as soil amendments. Bone meals can also be used for human supplements, animal supplements, dietary things of this nature as well. Those are just a couple of the things that you can do with this material. As I said, it's underutilized, and our goal then is to try to find uses then that'll sort of pay their way, which will help the industry in terms of providing an economic return.
In Kodiak, Bechtel says one company turns much of the fish gurry into products for use in other industries.
By and large, BioDry takes most of the raw byproduct out of Kodiak, Alaska, and makes it into fish meal and fish oil, and also a bone meal as well. They do a very, very nice job of that. There is always a little bit of protein, a little bit of other material then that is disposed of under the regulatory procedures in place.
He says there is an economy of scale that comes into play when making fish byproducts.
It's really a challenge, I think, for the small processor. And the reason is that oftentimes byproducts have a relatively low margin. And so if you have more of it, it's one of these industries where the bigger the scale, usually the larger the amount of money that you make. But even small processors and so forth could potentially make some humanoid-grade oils, maybe develop markets for pet foods and things like that. And there would probably be some nice opportunities in those areas.
It's not just salmon waste that can provide the raw material for seafood byproducts. Bechtel says pollock oil is the number one byproduct coming out of the state's fisheries right now. You can find out more about the value-added uses for Alaska seafood at the Alaska Fisheries Development Foundation website, afdf.org. In Kodiak, I'm Jay Barrett.
Options for an updated Southeast Alaska transportation plan include a tunnel to Sitka, a ferry to Gustavus, and a shuttle ship for Thorne Bay. But proposals also include cuts in existing ferry service, including no sailings south to Bellingham. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld looks at some of the options.
Last time the state updated its Southeast Alaska transportation plan, the map was covered with colored lines. It showed 5 fast ferries, new roads across undeveloped land, and inlet-hopping shuttles. In fact, the long-term vision totaled at least $2 billion worth of projects, and many never got serious attention. This time around, state officials say they're trying to be more realistic. They're gathering input before they put out a draft plan, and they say they're focusing on things that could be built. Andy Hughes oversees the project for the State Department of Transportation.
These alternatives focus more on improving transportation within Southeast Alaska versus connections to the outside.
Planners have developed about a half dozen alternatives to consider during what they call the scoping process, and they're suggesting some significant changes from what's there now, including ideas proposed before. Ferry add-ons include shuttle ships from Cake to Juneau and Ketchikan to Prince Rupert. Road routes include Cake to Petersburg, Hoonah to Pelican, and Juneau to the north. Other changes could resurrect the Inter-Island Ferry Authority's northern route, linking Petersburg, Wrangell, and Kaufman Cove. And another Prince of Wales Island alternative shows Thorne Bay getting direct ferry service.
Through the use of shuttle ferry connections and the road system, existing road systems, you could increase the connectivity between the communities several fold.
Other options show Gustavus getting a ferry terminal, so could Warm Springs Bay. The eastern Baranoff Island community would then become the starting point for a tunnel road combo connecting to Sitka. Hughes says it's an old idea that's gotten new energy with talk of a hydropower project at Baranoff Island's Tackett's Lake.
A transmission line between that proposed hydro facility and Sitka, it turns out they feel would also depend on a tunnel on the same alignment as our proposed tunnel for a road connection.
The plan's options do not include the long-discussed Bradfield Canal Road from central southeast to Canada, but Hughes says it could be added if there's enough support. A variety of groups are submitting comments, advancing their visions of the region's transportation future. Emily Ferry works for SEAC, the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council.
It seems like DOT is moving away from plans to build roads that we can't afford and is putting more emphasis on the thing that people care about, the Alaska Marine Highway System.
SEAC actively opposes new roads north from Juneau, across Baranoff Island, or from Pelican to Hoonah. The Southeast Conference also advocates ferry system improvements. Executive Director Shelley Wright says her group is looking at a variety of changes proposed in the plan, including village improvements.
I think the Cake Petersburg Road is probably top on our list at this point in time. We're also looking at some air transportation things. We're interested in the Angoon project that's being looked at right now as well.
Mm-hmm. The Angoon Airport?
Yeah.
And not so much the road north out of Juneau?
Not so much for Southeast Conference.
Among the options is one that gets rid of ferry sailings to and from Bellingham, Washington. It also eliminates runs across the Gulf of Alaska. Officials say that might be needed if funding gets extra tight. State officials are taking comments through the end of July, mostly through their website. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting from Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Jesse Zink in Nome, Casey Kelly in Kodiak, Ben Stanton in Kenai, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future. Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.